This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This morning, President Barack Obama delivered his much-anticipated address to a packed auditorium at Egypt's Cairo University, directed to the 1.4 billion people of the Islamic world. We'll devote our first segment today to excerpts of the address. Afterwards, we'll talk with critics, and we want to hear from Muslims in our audience. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. The president started by acknowledging the tensions between the United States and Muslims around the world. He spoke of Islam's role in American history and his own.
So I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. That experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. But that same principle must apply to Muslim perceptions of America. Just as Muslims do not fit a crude stereotype, America is not the crude stereotype of a self-interested empire. The United States has been one of the greatest sources of progress that the world has ever known. We were born out of revolution against an empire. We were founded upon the ideal that all are created equal. And we have shed blood and struggled for centuries to give meaning to those words within our borders and around the world. We are shaped by every culture, drawn from every end of the earth, and dedicated to a simple concept, e pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
The first of several specific sections in the president's speech in Cairo today spoke to violent extremism.
I'm aware that there's still some who would question or even justify the offense of 9/11. But let us be clear. Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people on that day. The victims were innocent men, women, and children from America and many other nations who had done nothing to harm anybody. And yet Al-Qaeda chose to ruthlessly murder these people, claimed credit for the attack, and even now states their determination to kill on a massive scale. They have affiliates in many countries and are trying to expand their reach. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with. Now make no mistake, we do not want to keep our troops in Afghanistan. We seek no military bases there. It is agonizing for America to lose our young men and women. It is costly and politically difficult to continue this conflict. We would gladly bring every single one of our troops home if we could be confident that there were not violent extremists in Afghanistan and now Pakistan determined to kill as many Americans as they possibly can. But that is not yet the case.
President Obama spoke of Afghanistan as a war of necessity. He called Iraq a war of choice, and he reiterated his pledge to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq by 2012.
And finally, just as America can never tolerate violence by extremists, we must never alter or forget our principles. 9/11 was an enormous trauma to our country. The fear and anger that it provoked was understandable. But in some cases, it led us to act contrary to our traditions and our ideals. We are taking concrete actions to change course. I have unequivocally prohibited the use of torture by the United States. And I have ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed by early next year.
At Cairo University, the president emphasized what he called America's unbreakable bond with Israel, described denial of the Holocaust as baseless, ignorant, and hateful, and on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he called on all sides to focus on the future, a two-state solution, and not the past.
To play a role in fulfilling Palestinian aspirations, to unify the Palestinian people, Hamas must put an end to violence, recognize past agreements, recognize Israel's right to exist. At the same time, Israelis must acknowledge that just as Israel's right to exist cannot be denied, neither can Palestine's. The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements.
Speaking in the capital of a dictatorship that is also a strategic U.S. ally, the president said no system of government can or should be imposed by one nation upon another.
But I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things. The ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed. Confidence in the rule of law and the equal administration of justice. Government that is transparent and doesn't steal from the people. The freedom to live as you choose. These are not just American ideas, they are human rights. And that is why we will support them everywhere.
And the president cited Islam's proud tradition of tolerance as he spoke about religious freedom.
Among some Muslims, there's a disturbing tendency to measure one's own faith by the rejection of somebody else's faith. The richness of religious diversity must be upheld, whether it is for Maronites in Lebanon or the Copts in Egypt. And if we are being honest, fault lines must be closed among Muslims as well, as the divisions between Sunni and Shia have led to tragic violence, particularly in Iraq.
Another issue that may have left some in the audience at Cairo University uncomfortable, women's rights.
I am convinced that our daughters can contribute just as much to society as our sons. Our common prosperity will be advanced by allowing all humanity, men and women, to reach their full potential. I do not believe that women must make the same choices as men in order to be equal. And I respect those women who choose to live their lives in traditional roles. But it should be their choice. And that is why the United States will partner with any Muslim-majority country to support expanded literacy for girls and to help young women pursue employment through microfinancing that helps people live their dreams.
The president also addressed the issue of nuclear proliferation, an issue he said had been a source of tension between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. For many years, he said, Iran has defined itself in part by its opposition to the United States, and there is indeed a tumultuous history between us. The president described some of that history and then went on to say, but it is clear to all concerned that when it comes to nuclear weapons, we have reached a decisive point. This is not simply about America's interests. It is about preventing a nuclear arms race in the Middle East that could lead this region and the world down a hugely dangerous path. All of us share this world, but for a brief moment in time, the president concluded. The question is whether we spend that time focused on what pushes us apart or whether we commit ourselves to an effort, a sustained effort, to find common ground.
We have the power to make the world we seek, but only if we have the courage to make a new beginning, keeping in mind what has been written. The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you male and a female. And we have made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us the whole of the Torah is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth. Thank you, and may God's peace be upon you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Excerpts from an approximately 50-minute address this morning by President Barack Obama at Cairo University in Egypt. The complete audio of the president's remarks this morning and a transcript are available at our website, npr.org. And today we want to hear from Muslims in our audience. Did President Obama convince you U.S. policy toward the Muslim world will change? If so, how so? 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Analysis, reaction, and your calls in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've heard some of what President Obama said this morning in Cairo. The entire speech can be heard online at npr.org. If the president's goal was to begin to change the relationship between the U.S. and the Islamic world, did he succeed? What did you hear? What didn't you? Again, we want to hear from our Muslim listeners today, part of that target audience. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Ezzedine Fischer was in the audience at Cairo University this morning. He teaches politics at the American University Cairo and joins us by phone from his home in the Egyptian capital. And it's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And how would you describe the crowd's reaction to the president this morning?
Well, the crowd was excited today. The last few days were days of excitement and anticipation. Not only the crowd who was actually in the hall listening to the president, but people in Egypt at large. If you talk to taxi drivers, students, people on the market, there is this guy who even made a T-shirt with King Tut, a symbol putting Obama instead of King Tut, and so on. So everyone was excited and everyone was looking forward to hear what the president is going to say about the future of American Arab and American Muslim relations.
And I understand this was also the hottest ticket in Cairo in quite some time. How did you get one?
Oh, that was very complicated. I basically asked everybody I know at the American Embassy, at the government, and at the university in order to get me an invitation. The invitees were quite representative of all shades and colors of Egypt. There were artists, there were writers, professors, of course, government people, diplomats, but also, you know, ordinary students and people of all walks of life. And those who didn't get the ticket were very frustrated. I had, you know, you get SMSs from people who are telling you things like, tell Obama we love him from the bottom of our hearts and very, you know, very touching stuff.
And I have to ask, there are some universities in Cairo that are regarded as strongholds of the Muslim Brotherhood, the opposition there in Egypt. Were they provided tickets too?
The Muslim Brothers were actually invited. You know, the Muslim Brothers have members in the parliament, and those members were invited. I have seen a number of those representatives present. Ayman Noor, who was in prison for quite some time and was an issue in the Egyptian-American relations, he was invited, was present. Barbara Ibrahim, the wife of Sadeddin Ibrahim, was there. Human rights activists. So truly, the people who were actually in the room were quite representative of the diversity in Egypt.
And did those people, I wonder, do you think they heard what they hoped to hear from the President of the United States when he talked about democracy and freedom?
Well, I think yes and no. I think the President was, as usual, very smart and careful in talking about these issues. Every issue, almost everything he talked about today is quite sensitive, and it hits, sensitive nerves both at home in America and in the Arab world. So if you listen to what he said about democracy and the American support and promotion of democracy in the Arab world, it was quite ambivalent, I would say. You can see in it, you can listen to what he said about non-interference, about the freedom of every society to choose the way their government is. And you can listen to the things he said, the specific things he said about freedom of expression and representation and elections and so on. So I think on this particular one, we will still have to see how he translates this into action, whether the U.S. will make this a priority or will just, stand by its values without active engagement.
And I have to say, you've been in Cairo when other American presidents have visited. Can you compare them?
Yes, of course. The comparison is on everyone's mind, but it is completely different atmosphere today. I was here when President Bush came twice, I think, in his last year. And by all standards, President Bush's visits were non-events. There was no excitement, there was no anticipation, nobody expected anything positive to come out of it. There was no interest in general. This time, it is a general interest. As I said, it's not only in the elite or in the policy community, but the ordinary people were expecting to hear something new. And also, I have to say, Barack Obama has a charisma and a magnetism that apparently transcends American borders. Young people who are not involved in politics were shouting from the upper chamber in the hall, "We love you, Barack Obama." I have never, heard or seen anything like this concerning an American president in Egypt.
Ezzedine Fischer, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ezzedine Fischer, a professor of politics at American University Cairo, who joined us today from his home in the Egyptian capital. Joining us now are Reza Aslan and Danielle Pletka. Reza Aslan is a scholar of religions and the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. And he joins us from the BBC's Bush House Studios in London. Good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be here.
And Danielle Pletka, the Vice President of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. She wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about what Obama should say to the Muslim world. She's with us from a studio at AEI here in Washington, D.C. And it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
And Danielle, let's start with you. What did you think?
Well, I thought that there were good things in the speech. I thought that there were bad things in the speech. I think that it's right that the president took an opportunity to speak to many of these issues. I wish he would have done it from somewhere else. I wish he would stop talking about the Muslim world. I still can't figure out what that is. And while I think that he used the opportunity in some ways very positively, I think that, frankly, he could have done more. He could have engaged a little bit less in some of the moral equivalents that he tends to slip towards. And I think fundamentally that there were important missed opportunities that we will probably pay a price for somewhere down the road.
Tell us one of those missed opportunities that you think about.
Well, when I think about the issue of democracy in the Middle East, when I think about not the Muslim world, but I think about the people of the Middle East and North Africa, we have hundreds of millions of people living there, largely under dictators and autocrats. The fact that the president didn't specifically, but did inferentially repudiate the freedom agenda of the Bush administration, at least rhetorically, one of the few good things that the Bush administration was able to do in this regard, was really kind of a shame. The sense that he embraced the idea that, in fact, for America to talk about democracy was to try and impose our way of life, rather than understanding that, in fact, democracy is a universal good that people of the Middle East and North Africa truly would benefit from, I thought that was an important missed opportunity and a shame.
Danielle Pletka mentioned that she wished the president had made these remarks from somewhere else. And Reza Aslan, I know you've made that point, too.
Well, yes. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, in the 21st century, the Muslim world is not really centered in the Middle East any longer. It actually exists on the margins of the Middle East. There are, in fact, more Muslims in sub-Saharan Africa than there are Arabs of any religion at this point. But it was obvious why he chose Egypt. He did so for very specific policy reasons. He needs Mubarak's help with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But I think Danielle is right. It did sort of hamstring him in some ways, particularly when it came to talking about democracy, which, by the way, every single poll taken of the Muslim world shows that overwhelming majorities say that the lack of political development is their primary concern, that they want democratic rights. So, you know, I would say the weakest part of the speech by far was the part on democracy. That said, however, I thought it was interesting that he went on from the issue of sort of political development straight to the issue of economic development. In fact, if there was one part of the speech that was that had the most detail in it, was the part where he talked about how the United States plans on investing in the Muslim world. He talked about how he's going to host a summit of entrepreneurship in the coming months, and talked about bringing more Muslims into the United States, expanding the visa program, which has been a complaint for many Muslims, particularly young college students who want to come here and study and work. So in a way, what he did was replace the more sort of airy-fairy notions of political rights and elections with the more concrete issues of social and economic investment in the countries of the Muslim world.
And let's get some listeners in on the conversation. We'll start with Khalid. Khalid calling us from Miami. Khalid, are you there? All right, we'll skip Khalid and go on instead to, this is Anel, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, calling us from Rabat in Morocco.
That's correct, Neil. Greeting. First, a fact, Morocco was, I want to say, was the first nation ever to recognize the United States as a nation. And look at that up at the Library of Congress. I want to tell you also, I have lived in the state many decades ago. President Obama of the United States has made tremendous improvement. I believe, and many believe, that he is restoring the world faith in America once again. But the many Muslims or part of the world, Africa or North, are very cynical, very skeptical. They have seen the double standard in the Middle East, especially when it comes to Palestinian issues.
And did you think, obviously the president said the gap between the United States and Muslims not going to be addressed or repaired in one speech or any series of speeches, but over a long period of time, do you think it was a good start?
No doubt it is absolutely making a huge difference, but time will tell, and action what will be measured by. Words can be said easily, and I believe that you said it correctly, Mr. Conan.
Danielle Pletka, rhetoric can be important.
Oh, I think rhetoric absolutely can be important, and I think that the president understands that that the platform that you want to work from in the United States is one that is positive. You don't want the default relationship between us and the countries of the Middle East and North Africa to be one that is negative. That being said, our caller was from Morocco. Morocco has broken relations with Iran over a number of things. Most importantly, some aggressive statements made by Iran. Iranian officials vis-a-vis their neighbors. You know, that's one of the things I didn't get enough out of the president's speech on. This is a national security priority for the United States. It's about not only our interests, but those of our allies in the Middle East, Arab and Israeli, the Iranian nuclear weapons program. We didn't really hear a lot about that. We didn't really hear a lot about what the president was going to do on that defensive side. We really didn't get a sense that this was an enormous priority. In addition, again, interesting. Morocco has really suffered at the hands of Islamic extremist terrorism. Now, let's call it what it is. It's terrorism. They've killed Moroccans, mostly Muslims. The president didn't mention the word terrorism once. I think that just as rhetoric is important, shying away from calling things what they are is not a good idea for the United States. Too many in that part of the world can't call things what they are. The very least is that the president can do that.
We had an email on that point from Omar in Columbus, Ohio. Regardless of what critiques say, I believe the president's speech was effective. It affirmed what I knew already, that America is not at war with Islam. If I could summarize a fellow Muslim who did not see the speech, I would say, none of us should tolerate these extremists. They have killed people of different faiths more than any other. They have killed Muslims. And Anel, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. We're talking about the president's speech this morning at Cairo University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me reintroduce our guests, Reza Aslan, a scholar of religions, the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, and Daniel Pletka, Vice President, Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. And let's go next to Rashid. Rashid calling from Detroit.
Yeah, how are you, Neil?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for allowing me to speak. I think today's speech by Barack Obama was just one that I felt was definitely needed. And I think rhetoric, going back to what your guests were saying about rhetoric, I think rhetoric is key in really opening dialogue. You know, to have a president go to the Middle East and open up by, not using the word terrorist, which unfortunately has this connotation towards Muslims where... myself being a Muslim American, born and raised, unfortunately the media and living in the post 9/11 era, I find that, there are Muslims out here who are trying to make a difference and, working twice as hard to, keep our good name as Muslims. And, I feel as though Barack Obama today sealed any, reservations that, I had. And just proves to show that he's definitely on the right track in, making that commitment to the Muslim world.
Rashid, thank you very much. Reza Aslan, I wanted to ask you about the president's remarks on women's rights and also on religious tolerance, where he specifically mentioned the Maronite Christians in Lebanon, the Coptic Christians in Egypt, and the bitter fight often between Shias and Sunnis.
Yes, and I think he did it in a very sophisticated way by putting the onus on Muslims themselves. I mean, he went through great lengths to talk about the history of tolerance and pluralism within Islam and used that as sort of the groundwork for talking about the need to restore that history in the modern world. And it did get quite a good applause line. And he also, when talking about women's rights, which was actually my favorite part of the talk, acknowledged that there is a debate here, but said something that I thought was very interesting, that essentially there is really no difference between forbidding a woman to wear the hijab and forcing a woman to wear a hijab. And I think that brings up this sort of larger issue of who the audience was. With all respect to Danielle, the audience was not the esteemed scholars at the American Enterprise Institute. It would have been ridiculous for him to have talked about the Iranian nuclear program in any sort of critical terms, because while it's true that the government of Morocco and the government of Egypt and the government of Saudi Arabia have a problem with Iran, the people do not. On the contrary, if you're on the streets in Rabat or if you're on the streets in Cairo, people see Iran and especially Ahmadinejad, or for that matter, Hassan Nasrallah, the spiritual leader of Hezbollah, as really the only Muslims that leaders that are actually talking back to the United States. And so he had to walk a fine line when it came to overtly and explicitly criticizing Iran. And the terrorist thing, I mean, let's just be clear here. Terrorism is a wastebasket word. Danielle might think that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, but the Lebanese do not. And this was a talk to the Lebanese, not to Danielle.
And Danielle, we have just a minute left before the break, but I know you want to come back on this.
Well, thank you. I do. Of course, you're right. The president wasn't talking to the American Enterprise Institute. Nonetheless, he is my president, and no matter where he is, I expect him to speak to American issues, and I expect him to speak to the American people, and more importantly, for the American people. The American people have been victimized by terrorism. We view Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. We are worried about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, and no matter where he is, I expect that he has our interests and our national security interests first and foremost. I think that it's important for everybody to remember that.
Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, Reza Aslan, of the author of How to Win a Cosmic War. We'll continue with them and take a couple more of your calls in reaction to the president's speech today earlier in Cairo, Egypt, when we come back from a short break. Plus, the story of some of the flyers who helped turn the tide of the war in the Pacific on June the 4th, 1942, a dawn like thunder. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. President Obama's speech this morning, delivered in front of a packed audience at Cairo University, his message directed to more than a billion Muslims around the world, and the White House did everything it could to reach that audience, translating the president's remarks into 13 languages, sending out text messages, even broadcasting on sites like Facebook, which has some 20 million users in Muslim countries. Our guests today are Reza Aslan. His latest book is titled How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. And Danielle Pletka, Vice President of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. We'll get a couple of more callers in. Let's begin with Moji. Moji calling from Tucson.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm just still in shock that one of your guests talks about the Bush's freedom agenda. And that's exactly the kind of rhetoric and policy that Mr. Obama needs to move away from as far as possible, to move away from colonialist divide and conquer policies. And what I'm afraid of is that, given that you've emphasized that rhetoric is important, and yes, rhetoric is important if followed up by concrete policy change. People in the Islamic world, specifically the Middle East, I'm from Iran myself, originally, and we have experienced colonialism for 200 years, and since 60 years ago, American foreign policy has become colonialized in that part of the world. So in order to follow up with beautiful nice words, we need real, concrete action that really respects the intelligence as well as the real fundamental interests of the people in the Islamic world and recognizes that colonialism needs to end. Finessing it with public diplomacy, finessing it with saying beautiful words is not going to be enough.
And, Moji, thank you. Daniel Pletka, I think he's talking about the perception amongst many in the Islamic world and other places around the world, too, that President Bush's talk about freedom was perceived to be as part of a rationalization for the invasion of Iraq, and also that these were words spoken by the president and by Condoleezza Rice, amongst others, too, that were never followed up.
Well, that's really the shame of it. It's true that the president really did engage in some of what I thought was the best and most important rhetoric on this subject that's been articulated by any U.S. president in many, many years. He talked about the lack of freedom that individuals in the Middle East and North Africa suffer under. Our caller was from Iran. I wonder why he doesn't live in Iran anymore. There's a reason why so many wish to come to the United States from that part of the world, and part of it is that they do want to live in freedom, as so many do. It's absolutely true. The president didn't follow through. President Bush didn't follow through on that, and it really gave a bad name to his agenda. At the end of the day, however, that doesn't mean that the United States should be stepping back from promoting individual freedom, from promoting democracy in the Middle East. This isn't a pretext. And I think that, to be fairer to the previous administration, the idea behind the so-called freedom agenda was much less about Iraq and much more about the flourishing of groups like al-Qaeda that have really risen up in the absence of democratic choices against the secular autocracies that exist in that region. That's really why we need to give the people of the region oxygen to breathe so that we can help support other choices for them.
Reza Aslan, can the United States do that, or are these are going to be movements that are going to rise either by themselves? How can the United States help, and did the President Obama today do enough to help?
Well, to be perfectly honest, Neil, there's a real debate taking place in this administration right now about what they're going to do about this so-called democracy promotion. You know, there are those in the president's own circle who think that we should return to some kind of realist foreign policy, which, to be frank, is just code or euphemism for going back to the days of stability over democracy. This, I think, is a great danger. I mean, Danielle is right. The impulse of the Bush administration was right. The application was wrong. And let's be honest here. Although he spent only a few words on the issue of democracy, in fact, as I said, I thought it was the weakest part of the speech. It also got the biggest applause of the day. And this has to be a warning to this administration that it cannot afford to abandon the idea of political and social development in the region because, as I said, this is the number one issue for Muslims. According to Gallup International 2 years ago, 78% of the Muslim world says that they want democracy and they want it now. But of course, they want it on their own terms. So we need a much more sophisticated way of promoting the so-called freedom agenda than I think the Bush administration did. But we certainly cannot abandon it.
Well, the president, of course, visited today, this week rather, with the king of Saudi Arabia and, of course, with the president of Egypt. Neither of which are noted for democracy or political rights. Anyway, thanks to our guest. We appreciate your time today. Danielle Pletka, Vice President of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, with us today from the studio there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Reza Aslan, a scholar of religions and the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, with us today from BBC's Bush House in London. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll be talking about the Battle of Midway 67 years ago today.